Exception number 8739, rule number 3.
Ramadan, rule 3.
Such as the carry area deception, and in fact the Germans thought right to the end, till it actually happened, that the assault was going to be much nearer the Dieppe and the Calais area that in fact it was. I'm not going to mention anything about the commandos or the US commandos known as the Rangers, nor the task that the gliders did, and nor the actual bombing on D-Day. All these were going on, but they didn't impinge on our affairs due to the efficiency of the Royal Air Force in keeping the German Air Force out of our way. The one thing we did all know, and so did all our families, of course, was that on the day D-Day was to take place, all our fighters suddenly started flying around with black and white stripes on their wings, because the one problem always was who is enemy and who is friend. Now, the whole problem of orders for an assault of any kind, and particularly of this magnitude, starts with the assembly of the troops, their preliminary movements, the right craft in the right place for the loading, where, having loaded, the subsequent movements are going to take place for those particular craft and where they assemble, where they sail from, the timing of sailing, the passage, the way they have to go, the way they have to get information for the assault, and then for the advance of the military inland. So it really boils down to where do the military want the one soldier, the one vehicle, the one tank, a particular amount of food, etc., on a certain day. And it has to be worked and planned back in reverse for days. And this was the problem. So it had to be loading, the passage, and the timing. It really was a terrible problem, and it was a very worrying one. How could one get it right? How could one possibly get it right? Because some weeks before, some months before, one had to start working on it. And so I, in my opposite number in GJ2, Lieutenant Peter Wyatt, who had the same job, we decided the only thing to do is we had the same types of craft, we were going to assault on adjacent beaches. We had to get together and fit in our movements together. We had to load an anchor or get them to go alongside at assembly points and then move out and get in other assembly points before starting and adjacent to each other. So we decided the only way to do this was to get together and plan it, which we did with our assistance, because two heads were better than one. And this is what we did. We met in the morning, had a very relaxed lunch, and then with our charts, our tide tables, the heights of the tide, the strengths of the tides, the distances, the speeds, the craft that had to go on this hard, the craft that had to go on that hard, we set to and went on until we had finished all the timing of the 200 to 300 craft we had to deal with. And this was the time they had to leave their assembly points to go on the hard, to meet the right soldiers, the right vehicles, the right tanks, and then to go to the right assembly points. And I can only read from our report of the operation on loading what happened. The loading went extremely well. The planned method of laying out the craft load numbers with the craft fleet numbers and the times at each hard were easily understood by the commanding officers of craft and the military authorities. 100% craft were available in the assault group. There were thus plenty of spare craft in case of loading accidents, of which there were actually none. As the Royal Engineers had more vehicles than could be loaded in the craft originally available in planning, two more LCT Mark V were loaded with AVRE assault vehicles, Royal Engineers. So therefore the loading went to plan and the assembly went to plan. It must be remembered, of course, that the loading started on D-Day minus 4, that is 4 days before the assault was going to take. And in the event, as we now know, but didn't then, that D-Day, because of the rough weather, was postponed by 24 hours. So it meant that some military, their vehicles, their tanks, and everything appertaining to them were on board some of these small craft under very restricted circumstances for 5 days before they even started to move off to sea. D-Day, as we had heard, was to be on the 5th of June. HR was to be at variable times according to what force was assaulting on what beaches. And this was due, the different timings, because of the water as the tide came up, and to be the water over the rocks. And the time of HR was, in fact, low water on the beaches, when there was a minimum depth over the rocks and the gradient was acceptable. The Eastern Task Force was basically an HR which was approximately 6:30. I say approximately, but of course it was exact. But each group, because of the water over the various rocks, varied. In GJ1, we were HR plus 10 minutes, and GJ2, because of the rocks on their assault beach, it was HR plus 20 minutes, therefore they were 10 minutes behind us. And so, from that timing, we have to work back to what time people left, the UK having loaded. Now, it was so complicated with so many craft that GJ1 and GJ2, We both, in our orders, showed every single craft as a dot, at least, or some mark readily available or readily understood to each captain for where they should be at various times on the approach. Apart from the sailing time, and apart from being under the orders of their group commander, they knew exactly where they should be at H-90, by a picture, at H-70, at H-50, at H-15, at H-10, H-5, at HR, and then right on to H-40, when our particular orders ran out. Everything from then on was on a timing basis. Now, just to remind ourselves what amount of craft we were dealing with. We were dealing with 18 floating tanks, the DDs, 4 landing craft support, a number of landing craft personnel large. There were 10 LSIs involving some 100 LCAs. In Group 312, the vital one, there were 10 landing craft full of the assault vehicles of the Royal Engineers, which are very vital. There were 10 landing craft tanks with assault vehicles. There were 4 landing craft tanks with rockets. And with them were 2 motor gunboats. There were 15 SPAs. I haven't mentioned them. They were self-propelled artillery. They were, in fact, tanks with large guns. And they were so organized that they could fire on the approach from their landing craft. And so really we come to the basics of the navigational problem of the passage and the assault involved. The minesweeping and buoying of 10 channels had to be carried out, each about 35 miles in length, running parallel across the English Channel from latitude 50 degrees 05 north, and accurately terminating at pre-arranged luring positions some 6 to 8 miles offshore in the same bay. The timely arrival of each group or convoy at the approach to its appropriate swept channel, with the subsequent passage through this channel and timely arrival at the luring position. Each group of landing craft, after release from the luring position, touching down on the desired beach at precisely at the scheduled time. It was also necessary for 2 of the British assault forces to sail from Spithead by the swept channel to the east of the Isle of Wight, and others to go through the Needles Channel. And in fact, if the Needles Channel had been mined, which was expected, all 3 British assault forces would have had to sail by the former route. In the planning, of course, one had to allow for the timing to be for favourable weather, so that the craft would not have excessive time in hand, and we also had to allow in the event for bad weather. The same time allowance had to be made, and one simply had to hope that they were right. And these timings, as I've said before, were a terrible headache. In fact, the weather and the tidal conditions on the day that were experienced during the passage were a wind of force 6, which was a strong breeze of 22 to 27 knots. The sea and swell were up to a nautical scale of 41, which meant a mean height of wave of 7 feet. And there was a cross-tidal stream of up to 2.5 knots. It must be remembered here that most of the landing craft had a maximum speed of 7 to 8 knots. And in a head sail, in a rough sea, that speed could be knocked down to 4 knots very easily. In view of the above, in retrospect, it can fairly be said that the solution of the navigational problem was, to say the least, an achievement. Again, we had the same problem of line of bearing, but it was made worse because of the weather and the strength of the tide, and craft had to allow as much as 40 degrees of leeway for the combined effect of wind and tide. Station keeping was extremely difficult, as owing to the narrowness of the swept channel, line of bearing was essential. But luckily, though it was quite good, it could have been better, but luckily there hadn't been any mining, so no ships were lost because of that. Monday, 5th of June, was D-Day. In fact, the decision was made on the evening of the 4th of June, because of the bad weather, to postpone D-Day by 24 hours. It was still, however, on the 5th of June, blowing very hard. and everybody thought it would be postponed again. But instead, on the morning of the 5th of June, it was confirmed, and the first groups, without any further ado, began to sail early that morning to comply. I think one must come back to the orders, because each craft that was leaving did so because it had been written down or been ordered by their force commander, their group commander, and by us. As it was realized, time would be short for the production of the orders after Force J's were issued. Our orders in GJ1 were started on about a month previously. All appendices had been completed and run off, and the main body of the orders were in draft form by D-Day minus 10. It was therefore possible to issue GJ1's orders within 48 hours of the arrival of Commander Force J's. And thus, when flotilla officers and above were allowed to open their orders, they had the whole set. LCA flotilla officers from the LSIs were allowed to open their orders on the day of Comforce J's meeting, which was 3 days before D-Day, to enable them to get roughly in the picture and explain it to their COs. GJ1's meeting was held the day after Force J's, and the loading plans, of course, were issued separately, as they had to be brought into action at least 5 days before those. That's right. I went on board with the captain and the staff at 10 o'clock on Monday the 5th, and we watched the first groups sailing past us. Group 312, which was the vital one for us, since it had the Avery for the actual assault and clearing the beaches at HR, sailed past us at 10 o'clock. Group 311, the next wave after that, passed us at noon, and so on. There was a very strong tide running, and I'm afraid, as usual, they were not keeping on a line of bearing. Still, they all seemed to pass us successfully and proceeded on their way to the boom without any dropping out. All our groups preceded GJ2s until after passing the boom, when they reduced speed and altered speed as necessary to fall in with each other. We weighed in the LSIs in HMS Lawford and our two destroyers and our 10 LSIs at just after 9 o'clock at 21:09 and turned east to go out on the eastern side of the Isle of Wight as planned. We had three destroyers with us, HMS Stevenson, a Hunt class, and a wonderful French destroyer La Commandante, and another well-known destroyer of those days, the Venus. As well as that, we had three MGBs. We had some US Coast Guard rescue craft to pick up the bits. And we had a number of other craft which had various tasks with our group. On approaching the boom, we saw the LSIs of Force S still going through the north gate, which was meant to be ours, of the boom. So we took all our ships through the south gate. These sort of problems arose all the time with the various groups, and it was an amazing sight. There were landing craft, there were LSIs, there were LCILs, they were going here, there, and everywhere, but all were sticking to their plans as far as they could. And I think it would be fair to say that up to a certain position, everybody was running to time and in accordance with the plan. To sum up the passage on that night, without going into details, one can say that most ships made the search channel entrances on time. There was a bright moon which helped, and visibility was extremely good. It was, in fact, even for us, in a well-organized ship with experts, it was difficult to tell if one was in the swept channel, as the Dan boys had dragged in the very strong tide, and it was, without doubt, a rough sea. The lights on Dan boys were not good, and they never really can be. Our groups were all doing very well, but there was no question about it. We were worried that there was no sign of group 312, which was the group that had the Avery on board, the assault vehicles of the Royal Engineers, which were really very, very necessary for a safe assault. As dawn came, we saw masses of ships all round us, all breaking into more or less their right positions. We and ILSIs arrived at the right time in our launching positions, but because it was so rough, we kept on a little bit further in to make a shorter passage inshore for the LCAs, because they wouldn't make their speed through the water. Because everybody was having difficulty with speed because of the rough weather, we retarded HR by 10 minutes to allow craft to get into their relative positions, which is what we had drummed into them all along, so that we could vary HR, but everybody would be relatively in the right position according to each position. Unfortunately, group 312 were adrift. Indeed, they were 25 minutes behind, and this did set us back, without a doubt. The divisions of 313 group, which was the SP artillery, opened fire for effect a little late, but it was reported that their fire was good and on the correct target. The LCTR, the rocket craft, fired at approximately H-10 and H-8, both a little early in their case, but their fire was effective. The LCGLs, the landing craft guns, and the destroyers joined group 311, one of the follow-up groups, and closed with them right into the beach and provided the most excellent close support. We had trouble with launching our DD tanks, that was group 311, because the commanding officer quite rightly realized that they would never last in the rough weather, the 7,000 yards they were meant to, and he closed right into the beach to about 1,500 yards when he launched them. But again, because of the rough weather, there were delays in getting them off. But still, they got ashore and did a good job, and they got ashore 15 minutes later. Great difficulty was experienced in the end in clearing an exit to our beach, and that beach was most congested in consequence until well on in the day. This was largely, I'm afraid, due to the obstacles on the beach, which weren't cleared away as planned by those that were in group 312, which was delayed. But I can only quote from the conclusions in our report that in view of the weather conditions prevailing, it is considered that groups did well to arrive not later than they did, and craft beaching were handled resolutely by their commanding officers. The 7th Canadian Brigade did not appear to be at all perturbed by the late arrival of the Avery and the LCTA, and carried out the assault in a most determined and praiseworthy manner. Looking back on it now at this distance, I refer the listener to the exercise we had on Slapton Beach, in which the criticism was the assault was too slow. In fact, the assault timing was exactly the same for the actual operation of Neptune, which is the name of this particular affair, for Overlord, and it just shows that there was so little margin in the speed of the craft that one really couldn't vary it. If they went full speed in fine weather, they made their full speed of 7 to 8 knots, and if they still went full speed in the rough weather, they were knocked down to 4 or 5. And this is why there was a delay of 15 to 20 minutes in the assault. But in view of the fact that it was so rough and the weather was so unkind, there's no question about it, in my mind, that we took the Germans completely by surprise. There was no reaction from shore on our beach for quite half an hour or even more. In fact, there was hardly any reaction, certainly in the assault area. I'm not saying about the beaches themselves, because I wasn't there. And I think taking swings and roundabouts, there was no question about it, but the fact that we assaulted under such bad conditions made the assault possible. Whereas if we had attacked and it was a fine day, it might easily have gone the wrong way. So taken all round, there were delays, there were bound to be delays, there were bound to be difficulties. After all, the Germans had put obstacles on the beaches to try and stop it and to try and make it more difficult, which they certainly achieved. But the fact was that because the Germans were taken by surprise, we got clean away with it, and I think thoroughly deserved to. And so for the rest of that day, which was the 6th of June, we in GJ1, HMS Lawford, spent our time helping the various craft to get through in various ways. And we went on doing this and checking the timings and urging people on to greater efforts until at 1800 on that day, when we left our job as assault group commander and became captain of patrols. There really isn't much to say about what occurred during that night. All the ships more or less got into their positions to produce this cordon sanitaire around the assault area. The main difficulty was communications. So much talk on the RT and on the radio that it was very hard to make any special alterations, but on the whole everybody got into position, and the night that followed was really very clear considering. The next day, the 7th, we went to HMS Scylla and HMS Hillary to report and talk to the Commodore Force J and to Admiral Vaughan, the Eastern Task Force Commander. And the next day, the next night, we again set up our patrols as planned and as before, and again we had a fairly quiet night, though of course there were alarms all over the place, but nothing really serious happened, except at about 0455, when Lawford was approximately in one of the berths, which was then heard as B-30 berth, there had been a signal saying negative influenza east, which meant that friendly aircraft were only in the vicinity, when an aircraft, in fact, was heard approaching from the Northard, flying low